Thank you.
You're welcome. Are you so happy that it's over?
Welcome back. Since it's always seemed to be my destiny to be the party pooper, I've got to draw you away from the food and the drinks and start things rolling again.
It's very good. The transitions were good.
They're having their own meeting.
Carpeting is really good.
Why don't we spread the microphones out so that they're easy to reach for all of you.
Props.
Those of you who were here at this morning's symposium, we heard some wonderful, wonderful contributions. Very eclectic. All of them, however, centered around this larger theme about how representation, theatricality, performance art, really, even when we heard the piece about the Supreme Court and all that, all of them interact to carry forward not only a message, but an actual effect, actual results at a level of changing the ideas of a society and almost more importantly about changing laws. What we'd like to do now in the roundtable, several of the sessions today centered on personal approaches and personal experiences to the play itself, Sandra Seton's Music History. And first of all, let me applaud Sandra, now that we have the chance, for the stupendous job you did. This roundtable is equally eclectic. We have, of course, the friends we heard earlier, Aaron Todd Douglas and John Woodford, and four new people, including Sandra, who come from various backgrounds. Rita Kiki Edozi is Associate Professor of International Relations and Director of African American and African Studies here at Michigan State University. Her research interests include African affairs, comparative politics, democratization, and international political economy with a focus on development. She is the author of People, Power, and Democracy, The Popular Movement Against Military Despotism in Nigeria, 1989-1999, Reconstructing the Third Wave of Democracy, Comparative African Democratic Politics, and as co-author with Reframing Contemporary Africa, Politics, Economics, and Culture in a Global Era. She earned a PhD in political science from the New School for Social Research in New York City, and she was also deputy director of the Institute for African Studies at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. John Leppard was the director of the play last night, received his BA here at Michigan State University and his MFA from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. John is the executive director of the Williamston Theater and an adjunct instructor at Lansing Community College and Michigan State University. A professional actor for 20 years. In fact, you'll notice that all these people will speak much better than I do. John has performed at the Hartford Stage, the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, St. Louis Rep, Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., the Signature Theater off-Broadway, and many more. He is featured in the films Mr. Art Critic, Barn Red, The Limited, Full Blast, and Whip It, and soon-to-be-released films like Red and Blue Marbles, Conviction, Scream 4, and Alleged. Rob Rosnowski is the head of acting and directing at Michigan State University Department of Theater. He comes to Michigan State University directly from New York City, where he was the National Outreach and Education Coordinator for Actors Equity Association. As an actor, Rob has appeared at the Long Wharf Theater, the Goodspeed Opera House, and the Pittsburgh Public Theater, as well as in numerous off-Broadway productions. As an educator, Rob has served on the faculty of Marymount Manhattan College at SUNY Stony Brook, the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, and Stevens College, where he received the Distinguished Teaching Award conferred by both students and faculty. He is co-author with Kirk Domer, who we heard this morning, with the recently released book, Collaboration in Theater, about the collaborative process between director and designer. The publisher there is Palgrave Macmillan. Finally, certainly not least, Sandra Seton, writer in residence at the MSU College of Law. She collaborated with Pulitzer Prize winning composer Bill Balcombe on From the Diary of Sally Hemings, a song cycle available as CD from White Pine Music. Her libretto taken from the diary was praised by the Washington Post for its subtle, penetrating power, end quote. Seton's play, The Bridge Party, is a winner of the Theodore Ward Prize for African American Playwrights. Her other plays include Sally and A Bed Made in Heaven, further explorations of the relationship between Jefferson and Sally Hemings, The Will, which takes place in Reconstruction, Tennessee, A Chance Meeting, set in Chicago's South Side, and of course, most recently, Music History. Now, I'm going to go counterintuitively If it's for me, I'm not here.
They won't even leave you alone now.
Well, like I said, I thought I would start this counterintuitively. Instead of asking Sandra, which we will ultimately, her thoughts and her process behind shaping the play that we heard last night, I thought I would ask first, to throw the pebble in the pond, the director, John Leppard, since part of what will be fascinating to experts and non-experts alike, this morning we talked about the content and substance and background of what informs this kind of theater, this kind of engaged theater, whether it is very understated or whether it's very overt. What I think we would find extremely fascinating right now is bringing the page to life. How a director approaches a text of this complexity because of all the subtle layers, and how it brings it off in such a small space, a theater in the round, with excellent but young actors and so forth.
Well, that's a big question. I guess I have to approach everything realizing that every story, whatever is involved, whatever subject matter it is, it's always about relationships. It always has to be about the relationships between people and how they treat each other and how they talk to each other. And in working with actors, one of the main things that a lot of people who are not involved in theater don't really realize, but they can see it when they watch a movie or a play. They say, oh, that one really worked. I can understand what's going on in this one. Because when the actors are listening to each other and talking to each other and actually we see those relationships develop, we as an audience are allowed to live in their world with them. So when Sandra first brought me the play, the first thing that I looked at throughout the entire script was where do these people connect? Where do they meet on the same page? And as I gave that to her, she made some rewrites and in some very important moments in the play where our two main characters actually come together and we understand their relationship finally. At the very beginning, we don't. They miss each other all the time. That first scene is one has an agenda, the other has an agenda, and their agendas don't coincide. And they finally find areas where they come together and we see that relationship develop. And for me, that's where the story needs to be, so that we as people can relate to them. I believe I said to somebody a while back, if the play is only about a subject, something that is non-relationship oriented, then we get bored. It turns into we are, instead of being told a story, it feels that we are being lectured to. And I didn't want the story to turn into a lecture. And so we, as we are given very important information about this time in our country, we are also driven through that information with the vehicle of a relationship between these two people and the people around them. So their parents and their fellow sorors, fraternity brothers and that sort of thing. So, I mean, that's how I approached it. For me, it's if we're talking about the space, it's a tough space, isn't it, Rob? But,
it was a challenge.
A challenge, but I kind of love theater in the round. I love doing that because with the actors, it's all about living in their living room. You don't have to cheat out, as you do on a proscenium stage where everybody has to sort of face forward and talk to each other like this. You can set people up so that you have to remind them. You don't have to cheat anywhere. You just look straight at people and talk. As long as you set them up so that half the audience can see a face every once in a while, it gives us the feel that they're actually living in that space. And for people who have not seen plays in an arena theater, it's a different feel than when you see something on an actual proscenium stage. But for me, it's just about relationships, about listening, and about living in the world.
Since we have, thank you. Since we have two other actors, and I think I'll ask Rob first and then Aaron, since a play, maybe analogous to a musical score, no matter how richly written out it is still a blueprint. In order to make it three-dimensional, there's so many other things that any actor can bring to anything. It almost seems obvious. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even less so than a musical score, because a musical score at least defines rhythm, but an actor can define the pacing. And I'm sure any 10 people will recite the soliloquy from Hamlet at 10 completely different speeds. Mm-hmm. In order to bring this three-dimensional life to characters like this, what goes through an actor's mind in order not to overwhelm the text and make sure that it still functions?
Do you want to answer that?
Do you want to?
You go. Oh. I've been talking a long time.
I think that it all does go back to the text. You talk about it as a blueprint, but it really is. An actor has to be both a psychologist and a detective to look there and see in that text what they can pull from, whether it's repetition of lines, repetition of words, repetition of habits, and start to create that character in relationship to their personal history, right? So we always start as an actor from, what if I were in this situation, right? So we start with our personal background, our personal history, and that's really what informs most of the choices, the text and our personal history. But then we also have the other element, which is research, which is something that I think a lot of these, specifically the younger actors, had to do to understand the stakes and the time period and the relationships that were so, and even just the mention of John Cage, or the mention of the different people and the politics of the time. It's really important for an actor to immerse himself or herself into the time period. But it really does go back to all about the text, and I think that's what's interesting in a world premiere or this first production, is that actor is the first one that has ever sort of lived that character. And they inform the playwright, they inform the director of what's honest and what's truthful about that text. And so you can always go back and see what does or what doesn't work. Is it the playwriting? Is it the actor? Is it the direction? And at this early stage of a play, when you, after you've done some workshops and readings of it, you sit there and go, okay, you can define it based on the actor's contribution. Yeah.
Especially for young actors, it would seem. And I wanted to ask you, John, did you find yourself working with the actors to draw parallels to their own lives with some of these references that, you know, just so far in the past for them?
Yeah, I tried. For one thing, the scene at the end of the first act where they are trying to find an apartment and they're chased off because they're not white. So I said, have you felt this at all? Has this happened to you? And Valerie actually had this, one of the parents had something like this. This happened to her within a year up in Flint, I guess.
Oh, really?
Somebody found out that she was African American, wouldn't take her into the, in their apartment. Huh. But they,
it's happened in Chicago recently too.
Is that right?
Prominent actor, disc jockey, I think it was.
Yeah.
Really?
I turned away. Yeah.
Holy cow. Well, they have not, I don't think they have felt it in the same way, that it's not as prominent right now. And so they had to, use their, suspend whatever they are feeling right now and realize that the world was a different place in 1963. And I think they were able to go there. I mean, I think they really, were able, through stories, they're actually talking to Valerie and through Pam, and the older actors were able to go, wow, this really is something. And it's still there. They still feel things like every single day, but not to the degree of you can't live in this apartment.
Yeah.
But it's still there in minor areas. And so they have to rely on taking that little, the nugget that's not quite as big as it was or was, and expand on it. And I think they were able to do that. I was very proud of what of their development through the process. And, especially Piaget, who played the lead, she was the one who kind of threw herself into the situations where she wasn't invited. And some of them were more in line with what might be happening to her. She would go to the John Cage concert and everybody else is white. And so she feels out of place. It's not as if they said, get out of here, but she still feels that strange, I'm the only black person in this room. I don't think I fit in. And she was able, I think, to relate more to that than, Marquise was talking about rifles pointing at his head when he goes down south. And that was the toughest thing to talk about, was what the difference between the North and the South was at that time. And, for me, a lot of my research came from my stepdad, who worked for the government at the time, and he said it was. He called it a jungle, and he said it was. You couldn't trust anybody. You couldn't trust the police. You couldn't trust anybody. Yeah. So you were really on your own. And that was That was a hard thing to get across, I think, for the guy who played Walter, Ken, just because the idea that you were really on your own. You're basically a troop down there. And working on something that was almost impossible, and a couple of those monologues, where he's talking about, you see 100 people, 10 people actually say they'll do it, and 3 show up, and then those 3 get chased away because somebody points a rifle at them. It's hard to fathom. I mean, it's dramatic, but it's hard to fathom that actually happened. And I think they did a good job. I think there were a couple of moments where they actually, were able to feel that sort of terror.
You mentioned something, if I might. You were talking about Piaget's experience of trying to find the outsider, that feeling of being other. And Sandra and I were talking about her being the beneath the character of this play. And that seemed like a powerful reference that we never quite got to circle back around to.
Well, I mean, in a sense, but then there are very few ways to identify African-Americans as intellectuals. The Beneatha character, okay, but she's the Etta character, but, every African-American woman who teaches at a university, or maybe who's a physician, or maybe who's a dentist, or maybe you didn't even go to college, but grew up attached to books or some sort of thing, there's like probably 5,000 different types of intellectual African-American women. We don't know these women because they haven't been dramatized. What has been dramatized is this notion of the African-American women as the other. And that's kind of tantalizing because it keeps you out of the space of the dominant society. The dominant society still gets to rule their space. And what you have is you have your little corner here that if you step outside that, people don't know who you are. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I think as long as that other is very controlled for African Americans, you really aren't able to envision progress.
Or true freedom.
Right. Because you're always, in some way or another, you're relegated. So if you're not the other in all these myriad dramatizations like Carolina Change, if you're not the housekeeper who's down there in the dungeon, like how many years later, Tony Kushner put her down there, and this other lady, and my husband said, well, her husband's playing the clarinet, and she's not doing so great up there, but hey, her husband might be playing the clarinet, but she's got a maid. I see her dress up. I see her wearing her, Lillian or Neiman Marcus, and her kid is expressing himself. She's worried about this or that, but that maid's down there in the cellar. So if you're dramatized, that way, then, and if the rest of the culture takes you a step below that dramatization, that other, then where are you?
You're in prison.
You're in jail somewhere. That's the next step now. You're not even in the society.
But what I thought was interesting about what you did was even the sorority house, which should have been a safe place, mm-hmm. had its own rules and class and prejudice within that.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was trying to look at it as if I were actually there observing, you know, living there with the characters, mm-hmm. but not one of the characters, because I really couldn't, in order to write the play, I couldn't be any of those characters. But you do have to look, you know, you have to look at all the different, if you're going to be real, you know, true, you have to look at all of them. Yeah, and there is that. And by the whole notion of the other and the dominant culture, I'm not saying, you know, among African Americans, you're going to have that diversity of opinions, mm-hmm. just like anybody else.
Right.
You know, you're going to have conservatives or liberals, you're going to have, you know, the whole range. But just that whole complicated sense of the human being, I just like to see that portrayed more. I'd like to see that diversity of our experience portrayed. And that's very, very important to me, because so many times I've seen things and I'd say, well, you know, I don't really recognize, when it's about African Americans, I don't recognize any of these people. And there's nothing wrong, it's not to say that there can't be, that this was a true, honest portrayal of a particular experience about African Americans. And I'd say, okay, that's great. Yeah, like for instance, you know, it was great, I really enjoyed seeing Fences, and that was an honest, true portrayal of that particular experience. But gee, I've never known anybody like that. You know, my father went to Fisk, he was class of 33, and his father went to college. And his father before that. You know, my father was a classmate of John Pope Franklin's at Fisk. So I'm not to say that I'm better than anybody else, but where's my experience?
I'd say that's one of the things that makes your work so poignant and affecting, is that we're seeing your scenarios, your situations, your settings are unfamiliar in a good way, you know, comforting way.
I just want to, if you don't mind, kind of jump in. And I want to talk about Etta in a bit, you know, in relation to Sandra. What you're saying, but first I'd like to kind of redirect it back to personal impressions and how I saw this really fantastic play. I want to commend Sandra and John for the performance. It really was fascinating. But you know, there are two things that I want to talk about. One is, for me, this play invoked comparative memory and generational memory. And so I am a black woman, but I'm not an African-American woman. I'm born in Africa. Nevertheless, I thought that the play invoked a period for me that I've always been fascinated by, and I've always researched textually, but this, you know, brought this period to life. But why I say comparatively is people may not know that Africa also experienced its own kind of civil rights period at the same time. This was anti-colonialism. And the stories that my parents told me about struggling for independence, usually in post-colonial cities like London, were very similar to the kinds of scenes that were being played out. So I think I was fascinated by the notion that this invoked memory, but also learning of a period that, as the new director of African American and African Studies here at Michigan State University, I've been researching, you know, the evolution of these kinds of programs, and they actually evolved in the period and the setting, the campus struggles for, you know, black education, for civil rights, for, you know, these kinds of themes. They evolved from these kinds of settings. So I thought it was a very interesting way for me to understand, you know, the history of the program that I now lead. But I want to go back to the characterization, and ironically, I think that I identified with the male, Walter, and not with Etta, who I didn't like much. And maybe because she was a kind of counter-ego, you know, she was very individualistic, and I like that, I think I am as well, but I sometimes thought that she bordered between individualism and narcissism. I didn't like the fact that she was a latecomer to understanding where Walter needed to be in the South, and, you know, why she didn't, you know, I was sitting there saying, you know, go with this man, you know, understand what he's trying to do. You know, and so I was gonna ask Sandra, you know, there were women, you know, during the period who did identify with the cause a little bit more progressively and quickly, perhaps why did you choose to represent Etta, you know, this way? And I also wanted to ask you, why did this guy have to die? I thought that was, why did he have to die? Why did Walter have to die? It was so tragic for me. I didn't see that Etta dropped a tear. Did she cry? Was there remorse? Or was she? Yeah, I thought that was, you know, quite amazing, because I was there mourning and crying, and, you know, I wondered about the ending. But I also wanted to know if you perhaps, you know, the theme, the objective here was to remind young people today of the kinds of sacrifices that their parents have made for the course, and were you kind of jabbing us that we're not making the same kinds of sacrifices? Hoping that you could talk a little bit about that.
You know, when, just to talk about my own work, this is so strange, but when Walter picks up that album and says Sleeping Beauty, you know, that's a reference to Etta's world. But it's more than a reference to Etta's world, because she represents a young African-American woman who, in 1963, well, she's a sophomore in college, and she is sophomore. That's one thing. Yeah. She's young, she's naive, and a little short-sighted, you know, in some ways. But you have to be that, to have the kind of youthful exuberance she has, you know, it's going to have its limitations. That's a whole part of being young. And she's excited with a lot of things, which I find attractive in her. You know, you have to have the blemishes and warts and all that, as you do when you were talking about the different the attitudes of the sorority. That's it. Because otherwise, you just have icons, and that's boring. But when Etta was coming along, you know, they didn't have courses in African American literature, not have been taught at the University of Illinois, period. You didn't read people like this, Toni Morrison Ellis, Walker, those kind of writers, they hadn't written yet. So there was no canon for Etta to look to. So a young intellectual woman like Etta would have looked to all those references that are mentioned in the play. Well, she's a trailblazer of sorts, because she stepped outside the group, and she's willing to show some things about herself that a lot of people that she's around. And in our culture now, you know, we're just as Walter hides that record. We're so used to hiding who we are. And Etta is a shero, hero, whatever you want to gone away because she won't hide who she is. And that takes a lot of courage. So I think, you know, in a way she's very courageous. You know, you wonder, well, why isn't she reading Native Son? You know, it's not romantic. And,
I just wanted to ask Cassandra, is part of the reason Etta doesn't go that she's just mad? She's tired of being patronized by Walter. She says, I'm not the Avon lady, and several times it seems as though she's just really angry at his patronizing attitude. So you got all these multiple things going on with her.
Well, Gabe talked about the people wearing masks. You know, well, they do wear masks in the play, and that's the first thing that our first conversation about Walter's mask. He's the jazz musician, he's the intellectual, he's the fraternity guy. And Etta has masks also. Frank has masks because he changed, you know, like he's one way, as soon as the women come in, he's driving, you know, he's so cool. So there are all these masks. So then I guess the challenge of your writing a play is, you've got all this stuff going, but then you're not supposed to show that it's going. And so I think I like that's a great reaction that you end up being bugged by Etta or liking Walter better, because it is supposed to elicit that kind of reaction and not like, well, is she doing masks or what is this stuff, you know? Whereas, you know, a playwright is somebody that's just like here, like, you know, like the puppets and you're doing all this with people, but then that's no fun to think about. So it's better that, you know, I'm the only one that thinks about that and doesn't clean the house up. And,
I was going to say one of my favorite moments in the play is you're talking about like when Walter, who's so brave and so courageous and who dies for struggle, yet he's afraid that Frank's going to catch him playing Tchaikovsky, and he stumbles over there and has to put on Miles, and so he's putting. So even though a guy can be a hero and you know, in many ways, on another level, he's afraid of you know something. He's a conformist in others, or at least you know at the time.
You know. Well, you know when Walter says. Etta, well, Etta does, in a sense, she does show too much. Most people, if there's a, I think one of her faults would be the fact that she lets it all hang out, and society does not accept that. They don't. Does that make sense? You gotta have your front. You know, like Frank says, man, you're blowing my cover. So what's Etta's cover?
From my point of view, the play, it's Etta's story first. She's the most complex character. As a white guy in the audience, I think I know something about Walter historically, not personally, but, you know, with, objectively, historically. But the character of Etta is foreign to me. She's so complex. She's trying to figure out how to be. I never had to learn how to be, I don't think. It was given to me. But she has to learn how to be herself. And part of it, part of what we see is this annoying teenager, self-possessed. No, that's the wrong word. Self-centered, yes. But that's only part of it. And I think one of the, why does Walter have to die? Well, historically, it makes sense. That's one way to answer it. The other way is it impacts Etta. We know it does. We're not sure how. We don't, because the play ends. You know, we can't speculate. After the curtain, so to speak, we can't discuss what's going to happen. But we know that event, the death of Walter, will help her figure out who she's going to be and how to do it.
Well,
nobody else is helping her, really, except by contrast. I don't know.
Well, being a woman, a young woman, it's exhausting, and it still is. It's just like, well, what is it Monica says? You know, it was hard then, and it's hard now. Well, you know, all this stuff is going on with her, and the fact that she can't, she's this crazy quilt, it sort of has to do, I think, with being a young woman, too, because she's thinking about how she's going to dress, she's thinking about where she's going to go, and she's thinking about romance, and she's thinking about all these different things. And so it is challenging, I think, just being a young woman and, you know, the way the society at that time.
I want to come back to the what I think was also the complexity of Walter's character. And, you know, I was curious as to why the gentleman over here described Walter's behavior towards Etta as patronizing. So I wanted you to speak to perhaps, you know, why you saw that as patronizing and not loving, protection. Okay. Okay. You know, I don't know. Maybe then also going back to the gentleman over here who says you know Walter or you recognize him, I think is what you were saying. And, you know, I wondered, that brought out to me, you know, perhaps the play between Walter and Daniels, Brother Daniels, right? You know, I think, you know, to add to the complexity, was it Brother Daniels? Frank, right, sorry. Actually, Walter is Brother Daniels, right? Yep. Frank. The play of these two characters, the reason why Walter is afraid to let Frank see him listening to Tchaikovsky and white literature is the, you know, double consciousness theme. We could see clearly that Frank was the caricature, right, of the black male identity, caricature, sometimes, you know, maybe towards the end it lost that luster, but I think that's how the play tried to play him. But, you know, I think Walter was also a complex character who was trying to understand his role in life and, you know, weaving between a black and a white world, especially. Okay.
But Walter puts, Walter was pretty specifically puts her down pretty, and although he doesn't phrase it in terms of panther pussy power ideology, which came later, but he makes statements that are tending that way when he talks to her, and I think that really alerted her to what was now called, you know, gender issues that probably affected her. So I think when she goes down there, I didn't feel really that she loved him after that necessarily. She might have felt compelled to go down to Mississippi and mourned him, but I thought that he, I felt that she kind of peeped him at that point when he behaved that way toward her.
Do you have a scenic example of when he put her down?
Yeah, if you give me the script, I can. Yeah, I do. He says, he makes some statements to her after she talks about their sexual relationship, what it meant to her. And he comes back with whatever it meant to him, and it's a different notion. Yeah, playing doctor two or three times.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, of course, they have an argument.
Yeah, but still.
I've never been married.
I've been married.
Well, this is like a typical argument between two people that live together. You know, I mean, especially you got to figure they're young, and. Who knows if they'd have been together a year later, but if people, the more two people, the way I see those relationships, the closer you are, the more obnoxious your comments to each other will be.
Well, he's supposed to be in the courting, he's still in the courting stage.
I
really, because they were both very young people, both a little egotistical in their own way, but both trying to find themselves and breaking out of some pattern that was holding them. And he had the cotillion mother and the expectations from his father, and then she had her situation with her mother and the sorority. And it's kind of a thing between, how do you break free and how do you be yourself? Do you, she's of the I want to be free category, and he's of the I want to serve category. And a lot of people find that tension within one character. I felt in this play, it was just kind of divided up in that way, but that there was a lot in common.
But even with that, they were still respectful to their parents. You know, I was surprised when she went to live with him. I mean, there was alluded to, and then the next scene, you know, the tousled bed. Okay, they're living together. And I'm thinking this 19-year-old and this, you know, guy, and they're in 1963, and I'm thinking, oh man, you know. So she went there. And so, you know, I'm thinking I was college, you know, in college in the 80s, and I wouldn't tell my parents. So, but that you went there and that it happened. And young people think, oh, in, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, young people didn't do the same things we do now. And that they took risks, and this was even before the pill, and you know, I mean, really, but big risks. That, and also just the reputation that she had to lie about where she was living and why and stuff. So I like that that they, even though they were trying to find themselves and break free from their parents, they still had to respect that, you know, those parents in a way that, you know, that they could, and while still trying to move out and forge ahead in the way, you know, to become themselves.
Well, that's good. You know, I wanted Walter to be a certain kind of person that could be viewed in his actions, you know, as a role model. He's a guy. He's someone from his times, but a Walter character would have been dealing with, in his present, the way African-American women were treated generally at that time, as not love objects or romance objects, but often just as sex objects, or, you know, that you could be treated very badly. And I had to, when I was writing the play, I had to go back and rethink some things, because I knew people in Chicago who were Black Panthers, and I know that the women were often in the kitchen, and that's what it came from. They were there fixing sandwiches over at the Panther headquarters and not doing some of the other things. But then I had to go back and put myself in the place, or put myself in the place of Walter, and what could be the fate of women who went out and wanted to do those same things, and the way they would, could be brutalized. And so that's another side to it, and I think Walter is protective of Anna for some of those reasons, you know? And I really had to, I wanted to see a character like that. I wanted to see how a character like a Walter would operate and make some of those choices, which now, you know, can come across to us as chauvinistic. But then, okay, chauvinistic as compared to what? And no matter how angry he was at Anna, he would never be allowed to hit her or mistreat her physically. And I wanted to see him do that. Because, you know, I could let that play go a lot of places. And I just wasn't going there with it.
Any more exercise today?
Wake up.
Oops. A couple things. I think what I like is coming out in this discussion is the talk about youth. I just want to commend both Sandra and the director, because I think a lot of times when you are, I think it's hard sometimes in a film like I'm talking about, in a play, to get youth, the spirit of youth, right. You know, because a lot of times in a place such as this, I think the inclination might be for some to focus on the big issues. But what I love about this play is that those issues are there, but it's in the context of young people and getting that spirit of youth correct. So, you know, having been formerly young myself, you know, you know that your heart is in the right place sometimes, but you don't. You are vain. You are selfish. And then you grow, and then you regress, and you do the right thing, you do the wrong thing. You're not going to tell your mother and father what you were doing. But in the context of this time, is in the time in the play, it's interesting that it's in the big issues. And just, you know, I'm sorry, John, is it?
Yes.
You know, I just thought you really got the young folks right. It just felt so refreshing to see. I mean, I'm just really happy to see black young folks on stage, for one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the tone and everything just seemed very correct to me. You know, you just hit it so well. I just thought that was very, very, very good.
Thank you.
And then also the, you know, the staging, I'm kind of fascinated by the limits that that are placed on it. So when they started walking around, I just got a big smile when they were walking in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just such a simple and perfect choice in terms of staging a neighborhood stroll. Good. Or in terms of staging the young women going to the apartments. Yeah, okay. You know, I such a compact, powerful play, and I think the staging plays a part in that as well. Thanks. So y'all did a great job, I think. Mm-hmm. I just think y'all did a fantastic job.
Thank you.
I thought the way John directed the play and his blocking was just superb. Mm-hmm. He managed to keep that play moving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had to stand back and just, well, I don't know anything about blocking anymore, so it wasn't even a choice, but I knew that he had some stuff, this bag of tricks. And he said, well, you know, this is going to start, this scene's getting ready while the other scene's finishing up. And I know I've had plays of mine done where you can see where actors are moving things on and off the set in the dark, and they got four or five people heaving and hawing and stuff like this. And so, you know, and they have to wear all black because there's so many of them. And, you know, I've been there with have the sense that there was that, at least for me, well, of course, it's my play. You know, I feel, you know, there's sometimes you can, you're watching a play, you can get nervous because you think, like, well, you know, this, there's a lag. But I thought the way you blocked it and the way you had the characters moving, you allowed them the freedom, if they had something that they really felt they wanted to do it, but then you were able to put them in spaces so that the round was used to its best advantage, and just you know, your the way you envisioned it, it just worked so well, and really,
thanks. Thanks, everybody.
Let me bring in a question a bit from left field. I was going to ask Professor Adozie this one, and it'll have a long premise now before I get to the question. So, and you can even just answer by saying you're not interested in it. But here, I'm going to tie in to earlier when Sandra talked about the difficulty not only of accurately representing an African-American woman as the other, but let's cut away the African-American part, the difficulty of representing a woman, especially in these days, because it's been decades since we've seen very skillful writing for women, actually. I mean, Hollywood has been dragging us in a direction where even secondary male parts get great three-dimensional shadings to them. The women rarely do. So the other at two different levels. And then there's the difficulty. I was noticing this morning as I was watching the younger students here in the earlier part of the symposium and just thinking that the incoming freshmen were born in the Clinton administration. I mean, not even in the in the Carter administration. I mean, we only go back, the living memory of these young people only goes back to 1990, 1992. And in many ways, much more than a history text, my feeling is that an accurately written and accurately staged piece of art, performance art, may actually convey some of these ideas in a much better way. And I was wondering, in teaching, in, for instance, political science, in your work in critical inquiry, now I realize it would be like asking someone who teaches drama if they use sociology texts or economic texts. Maybe they should. But going back to the fact that the dean of the College of Law this morning said that she feels that the college, that law should be one of the liberal arts, and that would be fabulous. Do you think that things of this kind can actually become a very informative tool in teaching in areas that are not necessarily the humanities?
Okay. Well, I'll you know, attempt to respond to your questions, but you know, my responses are off the cuff, so don't expect any kind of deep intellectual response. You know, in terms of back to the representation of women and particularly Etta's character, you know, I think, and maybe Sandra can correct me if I'm wrong, and it's probably the reason why I, in many ways, identified with Etta in many ways, although, you know, don't want to, because, you know, the negative side of that is that we're struggling not to be, you know, that narcissistic. But, you know, I thought that Etta was very much the typical second sex woman, the typical woman who captures, you know, the female identity, which is, you know, we are born romantics, you know, but that doesn't mean we can't be strong and aggressive and, you know, individualistic and, you know, at the end of the day, public advocates, which I think she was going to become. If you do a sequel, I think Etta will become, you know, that, you know, public advocate. She might pick up where her boyfriend left off. But, you know, the getting there and, you know, the ebbs and flows and, you know, this, you know, notion of wanting pleasure, you know, through romance at the same time, right? You know, I think that captures, you know, I think Sandra did an excellent job in capturing the complexity of the female identity. Not all women will say that we're like that all the time, but, you know, as a general kind of capturing of the female essence, I think, you know, she did a great job in I just think that I could identify with Etta even when I didn't want to. Yeah.
It really bugged me, and there are things she said, and I thought, why in the world is she saying that? But then, if a character's doing that, then I know I'm okay. I mean, you can't write a character that's, like, lockstep with whatever way you think things should be, if this is, it doesn't work. But I just want to say one thing about the male-female thing, though, that Kiki... I was watching the kids in the audience. There was a whole row of kids from the Black Student Alliance sitting in front of me. And when they got to the scene where they were on the bed together and when he kissed her, I saw they all went like this. And I think it just doesn't happen that often that you see a black couple in a play. At least, you know, admittedly I don't get around a lot. I don't see a lot of where it's just like being romantic like that. For them to see that. And, you know, great, if we lived in a different kind of world and like this was one of 500 plays about African Americans or whatever, which we don't have. But I guess just for me, for my own sense of what I want to do in the time I have left to be a writer. I just wanted to see that. I wanted to see that couple there to say that this is one of the possibilities. It's not the only possibility, but you know, I just don't see it enough. I saw that Carolina change and all I saw, there was this Caroline's husband, they show up this little vignette, and he's this guy in a wife beater. And they didn't show him bopping her, but he was bopping her.
You're trying to get away from the constant distortion.
Well, you know, to say, I mean, it's not to say that this doesn't happen, but if it becomes the only reality.
Yeah. I just want to answer the second part because, you know, that's so important. I've just come from class, well, yesterday, frustrated with the fact that my students didn't like this great scholarly book, you know, that I had assigned. It's a book on Africa. It's by Mahmoud Mamdani, and it's called Citizen and the Subject, and it's one of the classics, you know, clearly there. And here I am so excited that I assigned it, and, you know, getting a response from these students, and finally someone just said, look, I have no response because I just felt that it was inaccessible, complex, I just didn't understand, you know, I got modified. Like my whole lesson has just flopped. And so it also invoked me, well, I did tell them off to say, well, you do have to understand complexity and, you know, get through these kinds of readings. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I like to bring performance, you know, other ways of knowing, other ways of learning, you know, media, certainly theatrical performance. Students these days, perhaps, you know, my goal is to get the message out, right? You know, and so if it's to get the message out through this kind of performance, you know, then I can contextualize it and, you know, do all the heavy lifting. I think, you know, that's the way to go. And so I am ever more enthusiastic about incorporating media and performance, you know, into the classroom, you know, so that we can, you know, teach these kids, teach these kids, period, whatever our message is. So, you know, I'm glad you asked the question, yeah.
I had wondered if I could ask, I wish Professor White would say something about, we were talking about theater and message theater to do a job, the New Deal theater and the theater, the community street theater and these traditions of theater that they used to have. I mean, they censored theaters in New York. They had to go and perform in other places, but it was theater that had purposes, political purposes and other kinds. And I'm wondering if there's anything like that going on now, or what would it, what lessons do you draw from your studies of the New Deal theater?
The WPA-funded theater, right? Which often is called, you know, the U.S.'s only national theater, and that's incorrect. Really, it really was the only time that the government funded the theater in the way that it did, but it, Hallie Flanagan, who was the originator of it and the director of it, wanted it to be a federated theater, right? A federal theater, thinking about our system, and in terms of the diversity of the nation, the diversity of taste, the local versus state versus national. It was, so I think that is one idea to take away, is that she didn't fear complexity, and from that came giant bureaucracy, and from that came fear of socialism and all those kinds of things, but and ultimately censorship. But so I think that's one thing to think about in terms of the way in which representation, when complexity is embraced, can operate. And I just, in terms of female characters, black female characters today, I actually just last year directed In the Blood with Piaget as Hester. And she's a hard character to love. She's a hard character to like. This is Suzanne Laurie Parks. And so I think about her work, and I think about Adrienne Kennedy's work before that, and that the a lot of the is sort of canonical now, black female playwrights in the U.S., they wrote female characters that were complex and so difficult to like. And so, as Sandra was saying, difficult to recognize, for people to make meaning of, because of that, the way in which that image of what constitutes blackness, and particularly black femaleness, is so fixed. Did that answer your question at all, John?
We're getting there.
Getting
there. I mean, do they have today, I think in our, we have a drama interest group that meets in at Michigan, but they brought in someone once who, they're trying to do theaters in neighborhoods and put on just regular theaters that regular people can see, and writing stories about their problems.
And maybe this is answering your question. I'm not going to guarantee that I'm going to. But there is a movement called community-based theater, right? Mm-hmm. And Michael Rode runs Sojourn in Oregon. There's theaters all throughout this nation. And part of it is influenced by the UK and verbatim theater and documentary dramas and stuff like that. But it's writing theater with the community or for the community's needs, right? Rather than, I don't mean community theater such as like a Riverwalk, which has its important function, but that's usually the standard repertoire performed by members of the community, right? Non-professional performers. When I say community-based theater, what I'm referring to is theater that comes out of a particular issue. So, right. For instance, Michael Rode went to Cleveland a couple years ago and took a number of students from Northwestern with him because there had been an incident regarding race and racism at a Cleveland high school. So they worked with the students over a week doing these workshops and presenting back to them the issues in the community. So that, right. That wave is happening now, yeah. Is that closer?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
The
I think I'm going to try to connect your question to Kiki and this, and it might connect or not. But I think that one of the things about using art, perhaps in Kiki's field or in other fields, I think one, this is such a really post-New Deal, it has been such a hostile climate for arts. And, you know, the emphasis, I mean, to this current day, is that, you know, hard science, that's the real stuff, that's the absolute. Political science, okay, you know. And then there's art, very soft, very expendable, you know, suspicious, left, you know, those kinds of things. So I think that, you know, I think what happens is that teachers, professors use it perhaps incrementally and catch as catch can, or if something seems to fit really well, or if people really work hard to put it together. But otherwise, institutionally, culturally, nationally, I think it's a difficult time to make those kind of connections. I really do. I think that art is just seen as so expendable. And suspicious on a, you know, like a national theater, a nationally funded theater would be seen as, oh, no way, because all those lefties are going to be over there telling stories about race and gays and all that kind of stuff, you know. So.
Well, and that would be the problem with a nationally funded theater. One side is not going to like it.
Well, yeah. Other countries have them.
The NEA 4 eventually encounter,
yeah,
right? So the group of the NEA 4, National Endowment for the Arts, for performance artists, their funding was pulled, right? Because what they did was called obscene, right? So that kind of that set of politics they were professing, right, which was the gays and the women and the right, was obscene. It was considered obscene politically.
When you put the word national in, whether it's an NPR, anytime you put the word national in our society, it conjures up all kinds of things that are scary for some people.
Unless it's war. Yeah. War they go for.
Even though they have slaves.
But you know, quite apart the national part, to go back to what Professor Ray pointed out, I just came from a musicological meeting. You can imagine how dull that was. But one of the things that that we exchanged was when we have these interdisciplinary meetings, a professor of physics thinks nothing of coming forward and pontificating, for instance, on the context of the times of Mozart. But if we were to say, okay, tomorrow I'm coming and teaching in your physics class, he looks at you like you're absolutely insane. The idea that this is a profession that takes years of craft, and not only that, the reason I brought up the teaching aspect of it is most of the ancient texts that we know that illuminate the way we know the ancients were actually artistic texts. Their poetry, their plays. The historians, quote-unquote, are the least reliable of all. And the historians themselves are the first to say that. In order for us to understand the context, and here we're talking about dramatization and context, of how the people actually thought and felt and moved and feel, we look to Greek drama, actually. So that was why my question a bit, from that point of view, if one is to teach young people how to get into the skin of what it must have been like to have been a young person in 1963, my feeling is that this sort of an effort is far more effective to convince a young person to understand, if done accurately, not if done like the movie that you had cited earlier, right? If it's done accurately and done well, I think it's a far more effective teaching tool for the transmission of that sort of feeling.
Well, Gabe, you might remember that Billy Joel song, When We Can Start the Fire? Right. They use that all over the country to teach young people about history.
Well, there were supposed to be 20 kids here from the Black Student Alliance. And I did call. I called their advisor and I said, well, how do they like the play? They loved it.
They would.
It was fabulous. And I said, I thought they were coming to the symposium. Well, it's Friday.
It's 65 degrees.
But, you know, I thought, well, I didn't see it though. Am I missing something here? But they did. I mean, they had
because we called it a symposium. So the joke's on them, because it turned out to be great fun, actually.
But
you know, we really need to, especially in our program, you know, because I've done a lot of work on interdisciplinarity, and so in our program, we really do need to integrate this kind of artistry into, because these are PhD students, so, you know, they really should be here, right? You know, and we need to integrate it into their advanced research studies. So I just have to come up with ways on how we do that, a better job at that. But, you know, I really do want to take, yeah. Well, yeah.
You know, plays you know, work much better if you have some, you know, back and forth.
Yes.
I'm really interested in hearing what they have to say. So yeah. If there's some kid there who's thinking, you know, like, well, how come she's not reading Native Son? Well, if you're not here, then you can't.
Yes,
can't
interrogate that. Right,
you
exactly.
Know, you have to be here,
yeah.
For her to say, or how come she's not reading Alice Walker? Then I can say, well, Alice Walker.
Yeah.
She was
yeah.
And she was probably reading what, I don't know, The Fall and Decline of the Roman Empire or something, yeah. She was reading what was around, what was around the house. Well, maybe she wouldn't have been in her case because of her own particular, but then you never know. I mean, you really can't, you know, you just never know where people get things, and like Walter says, it's not like this stuff is under lock and key, and anybody can go to the library. So you'd be surprised.
I know our discussion has taken a little bit of a turn, but I just want to jump in on the using this as a tool in the classroom, using art. I require my students to go see In the Blood last semester, and Hester is a woman who lives under the bridge, and she's definitely not Etta. She's a polar opposite of Etta. She has five children by five different men, so she's the welfare mom that from the 80s, from a Reagan era, and all that that represents. And although I had one of the most intense discussions with my students after that, and we talked about the Reagan era, and we talked about some of those things in class, and we just kind of used the board to fill up all these parts of the play before I even started to talk about it. And then they wrote about it after we had done, kind of deconstructed it. And one student in class, actually, when we were doing the discussion, called her a slut, which is what she's called in the play, but he stuck to that. And other kids saw her as, you know, had a sympathetically looked at this woman. And you know, but it was just so rich that they were able to come to this and, I mean, had a really, really good discussion that day. And I probably one of, you know, a day that I remember as far as, you know, you said the days where I'm like, oh man, I failed. And that day I was like, oh man, I got it. So, or, you know, but anyway, but just using that as a tool, I probably couldn't have got him in here, but, you know, it's just, you know, it's a struggle. So at lunchtime we were actually talking about how do you do that? And they're probably, you know, Facebooking about it right now. You know what I'm saying? And asking those questions. And so, you know, it's really a challenge for us to think about the, you know, different ways of reaching them. And I just, that's all I'm going to say. They could be, they really are probably talking about it, but not in this forum.
Well, you know, I didn't have time to do it, but I wanted to create this blog about civil rights in Michigan. And that'll have to happen afterwards, because there were some students interested in setting up a blog where they could talk to their family about their experiences and just open it up and talk to each other and make it a living thing, which I think would be great, because a lot of these stories and narratives are about to be lost. People die with their stories or pass on with their stories. So I was hoping for something like that. That, you know, and it's, like you say, it's on the internet, it's a WordPress thing, so maybe. But I think that's great, because anytime you get that kind of diversity of reactions about something, then I think that's really good. Then that makes it's a real, it's something that's malleable, you know.
Are you still recording, or can I just talk loud?
No, we're still recording.
I do have one question.
this morning, almost all the presenters came to the conclusion that this play spoke to us now. And a lot of people suggested there were parallels between the early 60s and now. How would you address those two questions? How does it speak to us now, and what can we take away from it that would make us better able to function in the difficult times we're in now?
Well, I had something similar to what Sandra mentioned earlier with one of my students last week. You know, this is one who keeps falling through the cracks, and I keep trying to reach down and pull him back up. And, you know, he proudly proclaimed how he didn't bother voting because it doesn't matter. And he'll vote next time the presidential vote comes back around. And it was, you know, I'm trying to pull my hair out and express this to him. And, you know, he's just this scruffy middle-class white kid who doesn't care and doesn't feel empowered. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's important. It's important to make them understand it wasn't just for black people that, you know, we fought for voters' rights.
Sandra talked about how it made her angry that Walter dies for a right that people just blow off now.
Yeah.
But also now they're setting up barricades to keep people from voting again.
It's like the presence of a guard.
We're swinging back into that.
Yeah.
In 2000 we had it, and we had it this year too, barricading certain neighborhoods. Depriving people of their right to vote.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm from Chicago, and my alderman was murdered the night of the election after he, the black alderman in Chicago, Alderman Lewis, and he was murdered in his office the night of the election. So, I grew up in the inner city. I grew up on the west side of Chicago. There's a lot of stories to tell there.
This may be immaterial, but did he win?
He won the election, but he was too big for his
britches.
Do you think
the students
didn't read that book because they couldn't, or they
just wouldn't? Yeah, I'm struggling for a response to your question, but I think it's an excellent one. And so I'm thinking if this, if you'd asked the question in 2008, with the, you know, election of President Barack Obama, you know, said, well, you know, there was tremendous turnout, right, and tremendous support, and, you know, what motivated young people then? Was it a cause? And that happened. And now 2 years later, 2010, we look at the turnout at this election, and we look at the outcomes, and, you know, it's a more complex question. And so was it that we didn't have a cause that... Do young people always need a cause, or do they not recognize that sometimes the causes are, you know, more nuanced, but they still need to come out and support? You know, I don't know. I'm struggling with that question. Do my students, you know, I teach at James Madison College. It's James Madison College of Public Affairs and International Relations. And, you know, I expect to go into that classroom, and these are third-year students, juniors and seniors, to be, you know, passionate about, you know, politics. I still get students who say, well, I don't watch, you know, the news, I don't listen to, you know, I don't pay attention to the, you know, those kinds of things, and that amazes me. You know, it really does. And so I just think they're not motivated by, you know, political affairs, even when they're supposed to be studying it, right? You know, so I am concerned a little bit, you know, about, you know, the differences, right? You know, and it's not just my, you know, the students, it's my kids as well. They're not as, you know, politically passionate as I am. And so is it a different age? And this play helped me to think perhaps it is, because I had a lot of stories from my parents about this kind of age in Nigeria, about anti-colonialism and all the struggles, and, you know, that in many ways invoked my own, you know, political consciousness. Perhaps I'm not passing that on to my kids appropriately, or perhaps this is just a different context. But yeah, it's a difficult question, really complex one.
Yeah, I think that there's something to this whole thing of the internet. You were talking about Facebook, and I wonder if sometimes you have to be on the stage, be, you know, on this, in this space where they are. A book like the one you assigned which is difficult to get into. And when I was a student at Illinois, you had to try, and then you had to keep trying till you finally were able to get into that book. It was like a relationship with someone that you were, you know, you were trying to make it with. You know, you used to keep trying. Okay. Well, I don't know whether they want to do that anymore because there's the internet.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about that election. If kids, if it's whatever is there in their space, and if it's not, it was on the internet before.
Yeah.
And if now it's not there on the internet, and it's not like a part of that 24/7 media blitz, then how are they going to connect with it? It's not enough if it's just on the radio or in the New York Times, because who's reading that or paying attention to that anyway? It's as if they're in some kind of performance themselves. They're in this movie, or they're in this TV show. They are the show. There's something there, and that whole thing is the movie they're in or something. I don't know, but it's something that, you know, whoever you are, it works if you're there with them on the set, and if you're not on that set, I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does, and I think what's interesting is that theater is such an antiquated art form, right? And so I'm glad that those, the people that were there, the students that were there last night liked it, but when was the last time they were at a play? When was the last time that they actually experienced live performance? Because everything now is so mediated, how can we even, you know, we in theater know all of the time how personal and how intimate and how we can shade all of the colors and bring things to life, but getting students on a campus to come to see productions that are literally steps away from them is a really difficult thing, and we try to find every entree we can to get them connected, and that includes collaborations with departments around campus, but it's a difficult thing to retrain their mind from this sort of media, you know, mindset that they're in. But what's interesting about the play, I thought, going back to the question, was that it does offer an intimate and personal story rather than just sometimes issue plays become polemic and we are lectured at, and it's little more than sitting in a lecture hall, right? And so I think by creating an intimate story and creating a personal struggle, it becomes something that they can relate to, whether they can enter it from the idea of what's it like to date someone? What's it like to, you know, be in a sorority? What's it, so they have different entry points to the story itself, and then can take away the larger messages of that. And I think how it's relevant today, we also see, again, the thing that struck me the most was the sort of self-imposed class and struggles that were within the dynamics of the characters. And I thought that was interesting and still resonates today. And I go back to, you know, that bizarre interview with Kanye West and President Bush this week, right? And you're like, what?
Wow.
Did you that
Matt Lauer?
Yes, it was so strange. And like, what are you sorry for? What was the most upsetting part of your administration? President Bush said that it was when Kanye West called him a racist, and you're like, out of everything, that is what the one thing, you know. And so like, you, and it's funny because we think these issues go away,
that's my thought. So but then they wrote it down.
Well,
and
yeah.
And people left it in.
Yeah.
Amazing moment. Yeah.
And then they held Kanye's feet to the fire.
I know.
He had to apologize to Matt Lauer and President Bush on the Today Show. It was
the most awkward.
It was just
But again, it bubbles to the surface, and you're just like, every time you think that we've moved on, or you know, it's great to look back, you're just like, seriously, that's what, you know, that's now to the fore this week in terms of.
But the fact that a publishing company would leave something like that in, and all the editors, it means that actually a lot of people must have shared, they sympathize with Bush.
That was the talking point.
But they believe it in.
Yeah.
But they believe that in. It means it well. Sure, it makes sense.
That's the quickest way.
To be the most powerful man in the world.
Soften
some black guy knocks you publicly?
Yeah.
God, that must have been.
worst thing that ever happened to you in your life.
Yeah, I wouldn't have said that when I said about, you know, about people not voting. I wouldn't have said that in a general group. I mean, some of the things I'm saying now I just wouldn't say, because this isn't appropriate to talk about your play that way, because then it sounds like you just got here to preach some message, which I really don't want to do. And, you know, bringing things up like, gee, this is about people not voting. That kind of kills it.
You know? Right.
Yeah. You want kids not to come?
Talk about voting.
Oh boy. Because I heard my mother say that, and I don't want to hear anybody else say it, you know?
Well, on that note, on the close of our recent president and his selective memory, I think it's a good point to put a cap on this. I want to remind everyone that there's another show tonight, Music History, two shows tomorrow, a matinee and an evening show, and a matinee on Sunday. And tomorrow, Saturday, there's a talk back after the 2 p.m. show. And before the Sunday show at 1:15, there will be a director's pre-show discussion. So there's still lots of chances to see this play. Really very exciting. Let me thank everyone that participated today. This turned out to be far more stimulating than we even would have imagined. It's great that we taped this, because I think there's a rich store of comments, great questions from the audience as well. Thanks to everyone here on the DS. Thanks to everyone who participated this morning. Thanks to all of you, and break a leg tonight.
Gabe's vision that that was the inspiration for putting the symposium round table together. And
well, earlier somebody quoted Yogi Berra. Let me quote Leo DeRocher: "I couldn't have done it without the players."
Yeah. So